To Genesis chapter 7, I'm going to read a short passage from chapter 7. Okay, I think we're getting close now.
I can smell it.
Yeah. Yeah, he hears. Okay, Genesis chapter 7, verses 1 through 5 is going to be kind of my jumping off place for this. We're going to be talking about the flood. Last two Sundays that I spoke, we talked about the creation days, and how God probably directed the creation of the world. And then there's a lot of things that happen in between that time, from the time of creation, when we now have the serpent that comes into the Garden of Eden, and tempts Adam and Eve, and they give in to the temptation. We're not going to go through all of those, but we're going to go through the what now God did to the population as a result of this sin. Genesis chapter 7, verses 1 through 5. Then the Lord said to Noah, "Go into the ark, you and all your household, for I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. Take with you 7 pairs of all clean animals, the male and his mate, and a pair of the animals that are not clean, the male and his mate, and 7 pairs of the birds of the heavens also, male and female, to keep their offspring alive on the face of all the earth. For in 7 days I will send rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and every living thing that I have made I will blot out from the face of the ground. And Noah did all that the Lord had commanded him." So we see that after the creation, man lived on the earth for a period of time, and we see that this creation that God had made, it says in Genesis 1:31, "And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good." We have the idea that if we just clean up the environment, that if we just give everyone a good environment to live in, that everyone is going to live is going to have a good life. They're all going to be prosperous and so on. Well, man had an absolutely perfect environment back when Adam and Eve were created, and man still sinned. Man still tried to find a way in which they could sin. And so cleaning up the environment, giving people homes to live in, and all of this type of thing is not going to change their character at all. God saw everything he had made. It was very good. "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the 7th day, God finished his work that he had done." And so again, we see the culmination of this creation. Then we see that there was sin and disobedience that occurred. And the serpent came on into the garden, and God now put a pronouncement on the serpent, and in Genesis chapter 3, verses 14 and 15, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." Excuse me, I'm sorry, I should have started with verse 14. "The Lord God said to the serpent, 'Because you have done this, cursed are you above all the livestock, and above all the beasts of the field, and on your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel.'" So we see what God had mentioned to the serpent and to Satan, who is the embodiment of the serpent at this time. We also see what God said to Eve in the next verse, in verse 16. "To the woman he said, 'I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you.'" And then we see the pronouncement to Adam. "And to Adam he said, 'Because you have listened to the voice of your wife, and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth to you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, For you are dust, and to dust you shall return. It's not that God put the punishment of labor on man at this time. Man had to labor before this. They had to tend the garden. They had to take care of the garden. But the labor which they were now going to be consigned to was the fact that the labor was going to be so fruitless. You weed the garden, and 1 week later, what do you have to do? You have to weed it all over again. You clean the house, and what, 6 months later, you've got to go back and clean it again. And so these are the things that just seem to be so fruitless, and you just have to do it time after time. And I think that is part of what the curse is all about. It's not about the actual work and so on. But because man continued to sin, and even though God had told Adam and Eve what their punishment was going to be, they continued to sin, and life on the earth became more and more corrupt, more and more immoral. A man was waving his finger in the face of God, and so God had to come on in and now have a payment for the disobedience. Genesis chapter 6, verses 7 and 8. So the Lord said, I will blot out man, whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. We could spend some time on this aspect of God saying that he was sorry that he had made them. But the purpose is not to go into that today. We'll leave that for the people who are more competent theologians than I am to discuss that point. But we know that God was, should I say, distraught? And I hate to use that term when I'm speaking about God. But that man was so careless about his responsibilities and that God had to come on in and had to destroy man. So there was a payment for this disobedience. And the payment now took the form of the Noahic flood. And the windows of heaven were opened, and rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. If you ask individuals many times how long did the flood last, they will usually say 40 days and 40 nights. No, it was the rain that lasted for that length of time. The flood actually lasted for a little bit more longer than a year. And again, I'm not going to go into all of those things. But I have no idea how I got this picture on the computer with the actual video of it showing rain. All of a sudden, it just started to rain, but we see the rain that God had there. We also see what can happen when we have a huge amount of rain, that the flood is going to come. And so we see the windows of heaven were opened. Now, where did all of this rain come from? From the way the text reads, we really don't see evidence of rain before this time. It says that the Garden of Eden was watered by the dew from the ground. And rain seems to be something that they weren't familiar with. But there was a firmament. Now, I'm not going to go into the canopy and why I still think that there is a canopy, when many people now, even creationists, are saying that the canopy theory really can't stand up. There are scientific evidences against this. But there was a firmament, and there had to be a lot of moisture in that firmament. And this moisture came on down, and to have enough rain to go 40 days and 40 nights is rather unusual. We have rains every once in a while that are torrential. I was in Ecuador, and they have rains every afternoon there. And in about 20 minutes to 25 minutes, you'll get 2 inches of rain. And 4 o'clock to 4:30, that's when it rains. All the planes get out of the air during that time, the small planes, because you can't fly anyplace then, and so on. And it always quits in time so you can still get home for supper. But anyway, we have this amount of rain. But again, scientists are in disagreement as to how much rain there really is in the atmosphere. All of the water came out of the atmosphere at one time on the earth. How much rain is there? Most of them would say that there would not be enough to give us more than 4 inches of water over the entire earth, even though some parts of the world will get 300, 400 inches of rain in a year, which is an average of an inch or more a day. And in Ecuador, the jungle, this is what they get. But anyway, there was enough water in the atmosphere so that there was a rain, and it was not a gentle mist. It was a torrential rain that lasted for 40 days and 40 nights. So this water had to come from the atmosphere. Now we also see that the fountains of the great deep burst forth. This is in Genesis also, chapter 7, verse 11, the first part of it. And what were the fountains of the deep? Much of the water probably had been stored under the earth. We know as we went through the creation days and when the water was separated so that the dry land appeared, that water was now placed into one area and the dry land came on up. Some of this water, and remember in day two that the entire earth was covered with water. And so some of this water had to go someplace, and God probably stored some of this water under the earth, under the continents that we have. And so this would be part of the fountains of the deep, that these would now open up. Another thing is that the fountains of the deep and the waters from the fountains of the deep could now be exploded or would now come on out as matter of volcanoes. Now, when you think of a volcano, you probably think of dust and ashes. Some of you probably remember Mount St. Helens. Minnesota was probably a little bit too far away. But I know on our ranch in North Dakota, we did have dust that came on down from Mount St. Helens. There was dust in parts of Washington, eastern Washington, that was quite heavy. And so there was a lot of dust and ashes that we have from these volcanoes. But it's not only dust and ashes that comes from the volcanoes. We also have lava that comes from the volcanoes. Now, lava is molten rock. And I don't think that the fountains of the deep, that what happened here as far as the flood was concerned, were so much the lava, except for land formations that were formed as a result of this. If you go to eastern Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and so on, you have about 500 feet of lava on the ground there. So you've got all of this lava that was there. This came from the Cascade Mountains and some from the Rocky Mountains. So we have this lava which came on out. But not only do we have the lava ejections, but we also have a tremendous amount of water which comes out of the volcanoes. This is the Toutle River. The Toutle River came off of Mount St. Helens. There were 250-some people, I believe it was, that were killed as a result of Mount St. Helens. And many of them were washed away by the floodwaters. And so there was a tremendous amount of water which came out of these this one volcano. And Mount St. Helens, as far as worldwide volcanoes is concerned, is not a major volcano. So we have the floodwaters which came on out. And I think that the fountains of the deep would now be these waters that were coming. We see that many of the mountain ranges are basically volcanoes. You take the Rocky Mountain range all the way from down at the base of Chile all the way up to Alaska. These are all volcanic mountains. And so if these volcanoes were going off at that time, there would be a tremendous amount of water that would be released from these, and enough water to give us, along with the windows of heaven, to give us the flood that God speaks about here in Genesis. Now, we have some people that say that, well, this flood was just a local flood. What are some reasons to believe that this is a worldwide flood? Well, one was the command that to be saved, they had to enter the ark. If it was not a worldwide flood, and I hate to put God into this position. Well, you can't really do this. But, you know, to say, God, there'd be a more efficient way of saving the people than having Noah spend 120 years building this ark. If this was just going to be a local flood in the Near East area, God could have just moved these people. And so sent them up to a mountain or to an area that wasn't going to be flooded. But they had to enter the ark to be saved. And so it says that Noah and his sons, if they were going to be saved, they had to enter the ark. They could not go to some desert area or to some high area to be saved. All of the livestock had to enter the ark. Every creeping thing had to enter the ark. Every bird. And they went into the ark with Noah. And so I believe that from the scriptures we see that this was a worldwide flood, not just a local flood. Another thing is that the scripture says that it was a worldwide flood. And the waters prevailed so mightily on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep. Now, if you think about this right now, Mount Everest is the tallest mountain of the world, and I'm actually waiting for Barack Obama to change the name of Mount Everest to something else, since he now changed Mount McKinley to Mount Denali. But anyway, Mount Everest is 29,000 and change feet above sea level. So if you're going to cover Mount Everest with water 15 cubits deep, that means that you're going to have almost 30,000 feet of water. And our deepest trenches right now, our deepest oceanic trenches, are about 26,000 feet deep. And so we'd have to more than double the depth of the water. So I don't think that Mount Everest was present during Noah's day. Mount Everest is something that occurred afterwards, and I'm going to spend just a little bit of time talking about that toward the end. So I don't have a problem with this, that the water covered the entire earth, because I don't believe that we had the mountains that were to the height that they are now. We probably had what scientists call a peneplain during the time before the flood, which means that the earth was relatively flat. So the waters would have covered this. And another thing is that we see on many mountains and mountainous areas, this picture was taken from an area that's about 5,000 feet high. These are mud tracks. This soil was underwater at one time. And then the water dried up and formed these mud cracks. And now this is about 5,000 feet above sea level. So that was underwater. We also have something else, and this was found. I found this over in Utah in Zion National Park, which again is fairly high above sea level, about 8,000, 7,000 feet above sea level. This is called ripple stone. This is something that you will see very commonly on the edge of sandy lakes and sandy rivers where it's rather peaceful and quiet, not too much motion. You'll see that the sand is in this formation. Well, this solidified in this formation. This was underwater at some time in the past. And so that tells me that we had water above those areas. We also have a rock. This rock is formed from small bits of rock that have been cemented together. It's called breccia, for those of you that want to know this. And for those of you that don't want to know this, it's still called breccia. But anyway, breccia is a rock which has been small rocks that have been cemented together, and you have to have a lot of water, a lot of mineral-laden water to be able to form this. And so we have this kind of rock all over the world, which means that that area has most likely been covered by water unless something else has brought these rocks into this place. Another example is mudstone or siltstone. And again, mudstone or siltstone, which is going to become slate if it gets pressurized, again is a sample of having a lot of water in an area. So we have a lot of geological evidence that areas which are high above water today were at one time covered underwater. Also, it tells us that all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds, livestock, beasts, all swarming creatures that swarm on the earth, and all mankind, everything on the dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life, died. And so this also tells us that we have a universal flood, that this was not just a flood that was in the population area where Noah happened to be living. And with this, and that all flesh died, we have examples of animals that were living at one time in the past that have now been preserved by floodwaters. This happens to be a trilobite. Trilobite is an insect-like organism. There are no trilobites alive today, but we have quite a bit of fossil evidence in various places of trilobites, and these trilobites are quite well preserved. And they would have had to have a lot of water to form this particular fossil. You have another example of a clam that was fossilized. Now, one of the things that's interesting about this is that this clamshell, and we find a lot of them like this, they are in the closed position. When clams die naturally, they open up. And they are found in open positions, and you will have the two halves of the shell. If they die in a cataclysmic event where something happens that kills them, then they are going to be found in this closed position. Now you say, you know, you've heard the expression, happy as a clam in mud. Don't clams like to be in mud, underwater, and so on? Yes, they do. But some cataclysmic event occurred which now cause these clams to be covered up. And with the water, with this tremendous amount of fountains of the deep opening up and this amount of water coming on down, we probably had huge mudslides, gigantic mudslides, that covered up many of these creatures that were living on the bottom of the ocean. And they suffocated as a result of this. They were not able to get oxygen through because of the mud that came on in. And so the fact that we have clams preserved in this position tells us that we had a flood in that particular area or some type of cataclysmic event that caused this. We also have a lot of fish. And again, you notice that Noah did not have an aquarium on the ark. He didn't have to take the fish with him. They had a relatively good time. Most of them had a relatively good time during the flood because they had places where they could now swim where they had never gone before. However, again, because of the tremendous amount of turmoil with the fountains of the deep, the lava, all of these types of things that were produced, this is now going to cover up a lot of the fish, especially the fish that are closer to the bottom of the ocean, and is going to fossilize them. And again, we could spend time talking about the fossilization process and how this occurs, but we're not going to spend time on that. But the floodwaters are an ideal vehicle for fossilization. You have a tremendous amount of water. You have tremendous amount of minerals. You have moving water. All of these are absolutely essential for the process of fossilization. And this is one of the reasons why we have so many fossils. Getting off on a sidetrack, and you better get used to this because Bookman is coming in about 3 weeks. Getting off on a sidetrack, we have these fossils like this. They form because of them being covered up and all of these things, the water and all of these things occurring suddenly. And so they don't have an opportunity to get away from it. Here we have an interesting fossil. This is a fossil, and there are several of these, of a fish that is eating another fish. All right? And so now, if this fish died naturally of old age, he probably would not have been gulping another fish at that time. And so, again, this tells me that we have a situation in which we had a cataclysmic event that caused this fish to die in mid-meal. Scientists think that this is really quite something to find fossils like this, and they wonder what could have been the event which could have caused this. Well, I think that we see that it was the flood. We also have examples of dinosaurs. This is from Utah, from Dinosaur National Park. We have a tremendous bed of dinosaurs that have been uncovered here. And these dinosaurs are found alongside of a sandbar. You have a giant sandbar. For years, scientists were saying that these dinosaurs were probably fossilized where they were living. But we have many different kinds of dinosaurs. I forget how many different species of dinosaurs are found in this area. And they're washed all into this jumble of dinosaurs along this riverbank. And I think that what happened here is that these dinosaurs were caught in the flood. They were killed because of the flood waters. They didn't have enough to eat. Some of them couldn't swim. Many of them probably could not swim that long, at least swim for a year. And so they ended up being killed, and you had the carcasses that were now washed into the areas where they would now get caught on these riverbanks. And so you have these fossils that are found. And so the fossils of dinosaurs, which would probably have been able to survive a gentle flood, a flood in just part of the world, but were not able to survive a worldwide flood. Now, I also, since I'm talking fossils, I had to bring in, for those of you that were on the South Dakota trip this summer, I had to bring in some of the mammoth fossils that we found there. Now, the mammoth fossils were not formed during the time of the flood. I'm not trying to say this. They were formed most likely after the flood, as they went on in toward a watering hole and slid down in and could not get out because we have a very slippery type of clay in this area. It's truly, I thought it was very interesting to see all of the fossils that have been found there. But the formation of these, again, is the same thing. You have to have a lot of water, mineral-laid water. You have to have something that covers them on up, allows for them to now fossilize, and then someone has to come along and uncover them. So I believe that fossils are a good example of the worldwide flood. Also, as Scripture says, all the high mountains under the whole earth were covered. So again, we see the Bible that mentions that we had a worldwide flood. Then the worldwide flood was accepted by Christ. Now, Christ was New Testament. The flood was Old Testament. We had several thousand years in between the two. But Jesus said, until the day when Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. And if Jesus believed it, that's good enough for me. I will believe it also. Peter also believed it. And he says that by means of these, the world that then existed was deluged with water and perished. And so we see that the flood was accepted by New Testament writers. Now, another reason to believe in the worldwide flood is because of the ark. Now, the size of the ark was about 450 feet long, about 75 feet wide, 50 feet high. Those are approximate numbers. It was an ideal barge type of vessel. It was not a vessel that was used to travel from one place to another, but it was a barge type vessel which could hold a lot of tonnage, would be very stable in turbulent seas, and it was big. Now, the Creation Museum down in Kentucky, just south of Cincinnati, they are in the process, Ken Ham and his group are in the process of building a full-sized ark, which you'll be able to go and visit, and I think it's supposed to open up this next year. It's kind of pricey to go see it, so try and get some discount tickets if you want to go see it. But it's going to be an impressive structure. And to see how many things you can actually put into this is going to be amazing. We also see that the ark was big, and it is capable of having a pair of every type of animal which we have living on the earth today. Now, we would not have to have a pair of collies, a pair of German shepherds, we certainly wouldn't have to have a pair of poodles on there. But anyway, we would not have a pair of any of these, but there would have been a pair of dog-like animals on the ark. And there's plenty of room on the ark to have these animals, all of the animals that are on the world today, and then also to have food for them and to have the living quarters for Noah and his family. So we see the ark was substantial for this. Also, we see that it says that the animals had to be gathered. They could not just go off and do their own thing to get away from the floodwaters, but they had to be gathered. Warnings were given for 120 years to the people that this rain was going to come. The people didn't really understand probably what rain was. But anyway, we also see that the warnings were given, and these people had plenty of opportunities to be able to be saved. Then the length of time spent on the ark. Again, they were on the ark for over a year. Now, this means, again, that there was a more than just a local flood, that it had to be a substantial flood. We also see that there are sedimentary rocks on all continents at all elevations. This is one of my favorite spots in the world. This is looking down on the Bright Angel Trail. There's Indian Gardens. I've spent several nights there. You can head off onto Tonto or Plateau Point and look down into the river, or you can head down these trees and go all the way to the river itself. But all of these rocks, you have about 8,000 feet of rocks that are all sedimentary rocks. It's not until you get into the bottom of the canyon where you will now have non-sedimentary rocks. And what do I mean by sedimentary rocks? These are rocks which were put down by water. And so water, or some of them could have possibly been put down by wind, but it would have been wind which was blowing the dust around, because there was no vegetation after the flood to anchor the soil. And so you might have a few wind-blown deposits, but primarily these are water-laying deposits. We also have an example of a coal vein. This is from Australia. This coal vein is about 200 feet deep. They estimate that it takes about 100 feet of vegetation to give 10 feet of coal. Now, if you want really good anthracite coal, it probably would be 100 feet of vegetation for about 1 or 2 feet of coal. But we'll say that we have 100 feet of vegetation for every 10 feet of coal. We have a coal vein here, which is, I believe it's 200 feet deep. And so do the math, and you'll see that there was a lot of vegetation. Now, this amount of vegetation is not going to grow in one place and stay there until it can be changed into coal. It's going to rot. This is why you have compost barrels. You have compost barrels, you put your vegetation in there, and it turns into soil. It doesn't become coal. You have to have it covered up. You have to have a lot of vegetation. You have to cover it up. You have to pressurize it to be able to convert it into coal. So this tells me that we had a tremendous amount of vegetation that was carried into one place. Then we had silt and dirt that was piled over the top of it, which now was able to convert this into coal. So we have this. Another thing is the reason to believe in the worldwide flood is because I establish my covenant with you, God speaking, that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. And so we have the promise that there is never going to be another flood like the Noachian flood. There have been some awful floods. We have the tsunami, which occurred in Japan several years ago. Approximately 35,000 people were killed by the tsunami. We were just talking about the Johnstown flood yesterday, and the Johnstown flood in Pennsylvania. I believe there were about 200 people that were killed by this. But we have other situations. There was the flood of the tsunami, which occurred in the Far East area. Well, no, the in the sea around Thailand, Bangkok, Cambodia, that area, where there were thousands of people that were killed by the floods there. And so we have this example that if God was speaking in Genesis about a small flood, He has gone back on His promise. And the promise that we have is the rainbow. This is the promise that there will never again be a flood like the one that was found during Noah's time. And looking at this picture, I was reminded that I don't think that there was ever a time when we saw a rainbow on the ranch and my mother was around that she didn't remind us that this was a promise from God, that He was going to be taking care of us. And so this is a promise that we have the Sunday night when we were working on the church and cleaning up the church. There was a beautiful rainbow after some people got chased off the parking lot because of the rain. But anyway, this is a promise that there will never again be a flood like the one. Another reason to believe in the worldwide flood is because of the legends and the stories among indigenous tribes and people. There are approximately 500 legends, different legends, about a worldwide flood. The Babylonian Epic of Gilgamesh is probably the most well-known of these. But some of the legends, and all of the legends, have these things in common. There is a warning of impending doom. All of these legends have this warning. We have this in scriptures, 120 years. There was the construction of a boat. All of these legends have some type of a boat that was involved that was now going to save some people. There was the storage of animals. Somehow or other, they were going to have to get animals and be able to put these animals into a safe place so that they would be able to survive the floodwaters. There was also the inclusion of the family. So it was not only the principal individual that was saved, but his family was also saved. And one other interesting thing that I thought about these legends was that all of these legends, or almost all of these legends, have some type of release of birds at the end of the legend, to determine whether the flood was over. Now, to me, that seems to be a rather minor part of the whole flood story. But to see that these legends would all have this, the birds being released, I think it shows me that these legends have a basis in truth. And this truth is that they had heard about the flood. Their ancestors knew about the flood. And again, I could get off on dinosaurs. We see the same thing with dinosaurs. We have pictures, pictographs of dinosaurs from people that lived in the 12, 1300s and so on. Where did they get these? Usually when you draw a picture, this is something that you have seen, something that you have some acquaintance with. And so they, someplace along the line, saw dinosaurs, and they were able to draw these. Someplace along the line, these people heard about the flood and that of what it was like. Now, we see that not only was the flood an important part of the earth and the formation of our culture and going on into Christianity and so on, but also we see that there were there were other accessory things that occurred because of the flood. Job says, from whose womb did the ice come forth, and who has given birth to the frost of heaven? The waters became hard like stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. I think that Job was seeing some of the ice ages, and he was seeing some of the things that happened as a result of this. Were there ice ages on the earth? Yes. Does the Bible speak specifically about ice ages? Not other than in Job, I believe. But I think that we have enough geological evidence and that there's no problem with fitting the ice age into some time after the flood. We have a example here of glaciers. We have the map of the South Pole of Antarctica. And in Antarctica, most of these, this is ice. We have some areas here that's land right along the edge, but all the rest of this is ice. Greenland is also totally covered with ice. So we still have a lot of ice. And so if I ask you if the ice ages are gone in January, you would probably say, no, they are not. Unless you are a snowbird and head to Arizona or Florida. But what was one of the things that could have caused this ice to form after the flood? One would be the breakup of the cloud cover. Now we had this firmament. The firmament which produced the windows of heaven, the rain from the windows of heaven. And now as this broke up, this is the same way as if you are, if we have a cloudy day, well, let me rephrase that. If we have a cloudy night, it usually doesn't get as cold as if we have a clear night. Now, you've noticed that in the last few days, if we have clear nights, that it has gotten a little bit nippy at night. And if you've had your windows open, you've probably had to reach for your covers about 3 or 4 in the morning and bring those over you because the heat is radiating back off of the earth. If there was a canopy or if there was not a canopy, there was still this firmament, which I believe kept the heat in to the earth before the flood, and now the breakup of this allowed for the heat to escape. And as the heat from the earth would escape, this would now lead us into decreasing temperatures, which could lead to this ice age. We also have the evaporation of the floodwaters. Some of those waters, not all of those waters, went back into the heavens, but many of those waters went back up into the heavens. You know what happens when something evaporates. When water evaporates, you are going to cool down. This is one of the body's ways of maintaining a constant temperature. Scientists call it homeostasis. But this is that if it's too hot, you perspire, and as you perspire, the water changes into water vapor. It needs heat to do this. Where does it get the heat from? From your body. And so that cools you down. You have the Boy Scout method of determining which direction the wind is coming from. Licking their finger and holding it up, and the side which is the coolest is where the wind is coming from because the water is evaporating the fastest there. And that is now causing you to cool on down. So if we have this, the breakup of the cloud cover, this is also going to cause this, and the evaporation of the water is also going to cause the Earth's temperature to go down, which could take us down into an ice age. Now, if we're going to go into an ice age, we do not have to drop 40, 50, 60 degrees temperature. It's surprising how few degrees we would have to drop to get into an ice age. Another possible cause for the ice age would be the ash in the air from the fountains of the deep. We still had this ash in the air, and this ash can cause sunlight to be reflected back into the atmosphere. And if the sunlight is reflected into the atmosphere, this is now going to cool down the earth. There are several examples of this. In 1991, we had Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines that went off. There was measurable ash in the atmosphere that went around the earth from Mount Pinatubo. There was an actual decrease in temperature for 2 years until temperature got back up to normal. It was only about a half a degree or so, but that was only one volcano that went off, and we had the temperature that went down. In 1815, we had Mount Tambora that went off, and Mount Tambora caused crop failures in northern Europe. This was called the year of no summer. The crops just couldn't grow because the ash in the atmosphere. In 1783, there was a mountain in Iceland, and I did not put the name of the mountain down because I wouldn't be able to pronounce it anyway if you've seen Icelandic names. But this went off, and it was unusually cold for about 3 years after this Icelandic volcano went off. So now think you multiply this many times. Each one of these situations was one volcano. You multiply this many times by all of the volcanoes that would be in the Rocky Mountains and the Andes Mountains. You'd have volcanoes in Japan and all the way around the rim, the Pacific Rim. You have volcanoes over in Cambodia and various areas there, Mount Everest in that area. You have all of these volcanoes. All of these going off and putting ash into the atmosphere could certainly trigger a ice age. Then we also see that with the flood, I think we also had continental drift that occurred, that the flood would have lubricated the continents. Job says, "He who removes mountains, and they know it not, when he overturns them in his anger, who shakes the earth out of its place, and its pillars tremble." I believe that Job is seeing continental drift. He is probably looking and says, you know, 2-3 weeks ago I could see mountains over there. They're gone now. Now, continental drift is still occurring today. Probably not at the same rate as it was during Job's time or right after the flood or during the flood. But it also tells us the mountains fall and crumble away and the rock is removed from its place. And the name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. There's evidence in the scripture that something happened to the earth to change the continents. This is a picture of what people have thought of that we could have here, and that this was the Pangaea, one continent. I believe that this does not go against scripture, because when it talks about the formation of land, it's singular in the scripture. And so we could have one continent there. Then that this continent started to separate, moved over there, and now we're in the present age where we have the continents in this place. And so I think that they could have moved shortly after the flood, and probably, as I said, they're still moving today. This is a picture of the San Andreas Fault in California. This is a crack in the earth right here. This part of the continent is heading that direction. This part of the continent is heading this direction. In Southern California, it's moving at the rate of several inches a year. Now, it only moves a quarter to a half an inch at a time. That's why the earthquakes aren't very big. In Northern California, the rocks are tighter together, and when they jump there, they jump 10, 20, 15 feet, something like this. The San Francisco earthquake in 1906 jumped 21 feet. The World Series earthquake in the 1980s jumped about 7 feet. And so they jump a ways because they don't constantly move like they do in Southern California. But we still have continental drift, which is occurring. This is a picture right here. That is a fault line in the rocks right there. This is in Peru. And we drive across this twice a year when I go on down there. They have to fix the road constantly because it's moving about 6 inches a year. And every year, the one side comes up about 6 inches or the other side drops about 6 inches, and they have to keep fixing the road. And so, I've dared this by standing 1 foot on each side of this rift and hoping that it wouldn't shift suddenly a long ways. But anyway, we do know that there is continental drift. drift that is still occurring. Here we have a picture of the continental drift that occurred in West Yellowstone. This is the fault line right along here. This was a lakeside cabin. Now has running water in every room of the house. But anyway, this is a continental drift. This moved about 15 feet up like this. And so we still have continental drift that is occurring. We have movement of rocks here. These rocks are sedimentary rocks. Sedimentary rocks are water-formed rocks. They don't form at a 45-degree angle. They always form a flat. Something has occurred here to move these, and what's happened is that one part of the continent is here, this part is here, and it has pushed itself up like this, and so we now have these. So we have these continental drift that's occurring. Job also said, the waters wear away stones, the torrents wash away the soil of the earth. We see that there is a tremendous amount of damage that can be done by water. We have a picture of a hurricane, and I'm not even sure whether this is one that we survived when we were in Florida or not. I know one year we had four of them that we had to live through. But anyway, we see here that, sorry about that. This is an example of what Katrina did in New Orleans. This was all above water level. And this hurricane came on in. The waters did a lot of damage here. This is a before and after picture of a hurricane. Before, after. And we see the damage that can be done there. Now, God tells us, for they deliberately overlooked this fact, that the heavens existed long ago, and the earth was formed out of water, and through water by the word of God, and that by means of these the world that then existed was deluged with water and perished. But by the same word, the water, the heavens and the earth that now exist are stored up for fire, being kept until the day of judgment and destruction of the ungodly. And so we see that God has warned us, and I believe that the flood was an actual historical, geological event. It was something that God used to punish sin. And the same God that used the flood to punish sin all those years ago is still the same God that will punish sin in today and in the future. And Peter says it's not going to be by water because God gave His word that it wouldn't be by water, but it is going to be by fire. But that same God who did this, and I think that there's plenty of evidence to see that this did actually occur. This is not just a legend. That same God is going to punish sin again. And it's up to us to make sure that we have asked for forgiveness of that sin and that we have accepted Christ into our heart to wash away that sin. I'll turn it back to Brian at this time.